I wanted to start off really with a little background. Your book, Keokuk and the Great Dam, where did this idea come from? Why did you feel this was a topic to look at?
Well, I write on Illinois extensively, have 24 books in print, and also am interested particularly in the Western Illinois area because I was with Western Illinois University for 35 years. And so also am interested in eastern Iowa and northeastern Missouri, for that matter, the stretch of the river that comes up here. And so have been interested in all sorts of historical matters related to this region for a long, long time. One of my books, done in the early 80s, it was called Western Illinois Heritage, for example, which sometimes gets across the river a little bit, too, because of that. But very much into regional history. And this is an important, of course, aspect. This dam, this hydroelectric power dam between Keokuk and Hamilton, an extremely important part of the history of the area. It changed things dramatically.
How did it? Well, I mean, why is it important? How did it change things?
Well, of course, at the time, it's hard for us to believe now when we've got more than 20 dams across the Mississippi River, but there were no dams across the river. Moreover, people said, as I mentioned in my book, Keokuk and the Great Dam, that damming the Mississippi River was actually used as a metaphor in the 19th century for you can't do it. Like you can as easily do that as dam the Mississippi River. You know, it just is too big. You've got too much power behind the water, and it's just something people can never do. So it's in the category of they said it couldn't be done. So that's fascinating. But also, of course, it changed things dramatically because it allowed for easier travel up and down the river as a result of that, not to mention hydroelectric power that came in with the dam to the Midwest, power that was transferred as far south as St. Louis. And there's other reasons, too. I mean, the project itself was the largest privately funded construction project in history, period, anywhere, when it was done. So you can imagine it often attracted, when it was being done between 1910 and 1913, it attracted sometimes people from other countries who wanted to come and see this massive, incredible project that was going on. They're damming this absolutely huge, powerful river, a river given to flooding, as everybody knew, and everything else. But they were going to do it one way or the other. And it was beyond that. It was part of America's sense of manifest destiny at the time. You know, that concept that it's our destiny that early Americans had to go across this continent and make this a continental United States of America. That's what we are here to do. And as if it's a God-given job for us. And they began to see in the late 19th century and early 20th the damming of the Mississippi River as part of our kind of manifest destiny. We've got to control this central river and make it a place that really works well for transportation. And I might explain that a little bit. Behind it all, historically, is the problem of the Des Moines Rapids, a shallow area of the Mississippi River, right from roughly the Keokuk area extending north for a period of miles, shallow, rocky, and you couldn't get through it with a loaded riverboat. Riverboats started coming in 1820. That was the beginning of the Mississippi River, riverboat era on the upper Mississippi. But the problem was that if you had a boat of any weight or it was fairly shallow water, you couldn't get through the rapids. And so you'd have to take the boat over to Keokuk, which is what made Keokuk such a viable early river town. You had to unload whatever goods you had on the boat onto the shore, put them onto wagons, send that up several miles to the north, take your boat and sort of tow it up empty, you see, so it wouldn't have a very deep draft into the river, Tow it over the rapids, then reload it several miles north and take it on up. Well, of course, on the one hand, this prevents the growth of riverboats. You can't get bigger, heavier riverboats because you're already held up by that, and it makes it expensive to do that, what they call break-in-bulk operation there. And so that was the ultimate problem they were solving. They solved it once, actually, historically, with something that was remarkable, too. They had government money because the government naturally wanted the river to be fully navigable, you see. And so the work was done by the U.S. Corps of Engineers between 1867 and 1877. 10 years, they built a canal on the Iowa side, a canal so you could bring boats up, steer them into the canal that had three locks on it, and you could bring them along the Iowa shore carefully and slowly and then release them at the end of several miles. And that was much quicker and better than having to take everything off the boat and sort of tow it. So the canal operated from 1877, often a couple thousand boats and more a year in that canal, moving up and down. That wasn't a permanent solution. You know, as the river became more busy, boats became bigger, problems that way. Also, there was a desire for hydroelectric power that came in at the turn of the century. So that's what ultimately led to this larger conception of the dam.
Who was the driving force behind it? I mean, if it's something that they said it couldn't be done, who started to say, let's see if we can do it? Where'd that driving force come from?
Actually, it came from local leaders in Keokuk. I called my book Keokuk and the Great Dam, and let me tell you something about it. It was put out in the Images of America series by Arcadia Press, and Arcadia Press is a familiar one. If you go in bookstores, they have pictorial books of every town that's of any tourist interest or of any size in the country, and but they're just little picture books, and sometimes they move roughly chronologically, but that's about the size of it. With Keokuk and the Great Dam, I told the publishers, we're going to do something different here. This is going to have a plot. I'm going to give the history of Keokuk, okay, but also this is a very special town that did something that was really responsible for something that was fantastic, that had an impact on America and had a worldwide reputation. They wanted to become, by the late 19th century, little Keokuk there, which had maybe 8,000 people by 1860, roughly the time of the Civil War. But it dreamed of becoming another St. Louis. It became, you know, St. Louis was 144 miles further south, but they dreamed of becoming like St. Louis, a city on the river. And if they could do this, if they could dam the river right at their place and produce hydroelectricity on top of it, wow, they'd become a center for hydroelectric power in the Midwest. They'd become a place that would be something to see for people because you'd have this huge dam. And so they had this notion of damming the Mississippi River that was talked about now and again among local leadership in Keokuk. And by 1903, a group of them working with the Corps of Engineers put in front of Congress and the president a bill. Of course, they had to get permission. You can't just locally dam a public river in the United States, much less the Central River. And so they had to get permission from the government, and they did. By 1905, President Roosevelt signed the congressional bill giving permission to build a dam at that point in the Mississippi River. Now, Roosevelt, incidentally, who was given to doing great projects like this, had 2 years earlier in 1903 signed a bill and not only giving permission to but funding the Panama Canal. And so that was underway already as of 1903, and that would go until 1914, this huge construction project. And so the dam at Keokuk was not as large as that one as a project, but it was not government funded. This was a privately funded matter, and that was the issue. The government said, okay, you can dam, you people of Keokuk and so forth, you can dam the river there if you get the right people to do it and the funding for doing it. So they had to search for funding in the United States. They fortunately attracted an amazing engineer named Hugh Cooper. Cooper was a self-taught engineer who was born in 1865 in a small town in southern Minnesota. And he really sort of ran off. He worked for his father, but sort of ran off as a kid and worked building timber bridges for a railroad company, and then worked for a company in Ohio, in Dayton, manufacturing hydroelectric machinery. He knew that things were coming in regard to hydroelectricity. Of course, everybody was fascinated in the late 19th century by the coming of electricity. You could see it at the World's Fairs, for example, things like that, illustrations. And cities were starting to get hydroelectricity, or rather, not hydro, but starting to get electricity. And so people were talking about hydroelectric power. He learned how to do that, worked for a company that built power dams then, power plants in New York, but also in other countries, Jamaica, Brazil, for example, returned to America in 1901, and then really was contacted by Keokuk people, got involved, and he was the one who then, as the head engineer, was the lead, taking the lead in seeking major funding from investment agencies in the country. They finally got a company in Boston to get behind the project, and because Americans felt like, you will never dam the Mississippi River. You really couldn't get American investors to do it. But Canadian investors and European investors were the major sources of money for this American dam. They just maybe didn't have as much experience with the river over the years and weren't as afraid of it. But in any case, that's where they got it. And just shortly before, they had a time limit when the bill was passed that they had to a certain month in 1910 to get this underway, or otherwise the permission would be void. And just a month before that was up, they started in 1910, they had the funding and started in building the Great Dam at Keokuk.
I believe, it's funny to think about the cost now versus back then, but I believe, was it $14 million? Is that what he had to secure?
I can't recall exactly. It was somewhere between 14 and 20 that they thought it would cost. It ended up costing $27 million. And, of course, at that time, a million at that time was worth many millions today. So you can imagine it would be a huge, huge project in terms of cost. But he loved it. Cooper was the kind of guy who was attracted by the challenge of major projects. He was a brilliant problem solver. And whoa, there were problems on this project. For example, nobody had figured out yet how to send electric power over an extended distance, because the power would decline and decline and decline with the distance. And so, you know, 20 miles, it would have a little, and 40 miles, there wouldn't be much. And that's it. How are you going to send power to St. Louis? He felt that there were ways to do it. And he eventually solved that problem. That was one of several problems. Also, no one had ever built turbines nearly this big. He built the largest turbines in the history of the world to go into that dam. So a lot of challenges there. But he's the guy who just loved that kind of thing. So he was glad to sign up for it. He knew that there would be a kind of historic value to this, as well as, of course, a good deal of money, because he's not only paid for being an engineer, he was given, you might say, a certain percentage of the stock in the company, more or less, and which was worth a lot of money. Certainly, I think he sold some of it soon after the dam was done for several hundred thousand dollars, the equivalent of many millions of dollars today, and that was just part of it. So there was also wealth involved, but it really a guy who loved major challenges and decided to take it on and put the the whole operation together and draw in the kind of workers that you needed, which hundreds of workers were brought in, some of them immigrant workers from Italy or Germany, places like that, who had specific skills that he wanted. Of course, he had a design done, a man by the name of Loring H. Provine, who's not very well known, but I mentioned him in Keokuk and the Great Dam, who incidentally was raised in my hometown of Macomb, did the design for that and the cost estimate. And he was educated in engineering, architectural engineering at the University of Illinois. And later on, right after the dam project was done, 1914 to 1948, a long time, he chaired the architecture department at the University of Illinois. So a remarkably talented guy brought in at the beginning to sketch it out. And they started in, of course, and had all sorts of challenges along the way.
What were some of the challenges as it got going? Just the idea you're doing. I know he used, it was almost just rudimentary wagons and buckets and trying to deal with the river like that. What were the biggest challenges he was facing?
Well, yes, just the size of the river, the power of the river were huge considerations. And let me just say, for example, that you had to take sections of the river. First, he started on both shores, two different crews, on the Iowa and Illinois side, and you had to put footings in that you had to remove the earth and then go down. If you hit rock, you had to drill, get the rock out, and go down deep enough, 20 feet, whatever, to put in your footing for the ends of the dam, and then work toward the middle of the river from both sides. And, of course, as you got out in the river, you had to create cofferdams. A cofferdam is a thing built out of really wooden posts that created an area in the river that was set aside or surrounded, and then you put a huge pump on it, and you pump out the water that's locked in the middle of that cofferdam so that you have this muddy bottom to deal with. And then you remove the mud, the dirt from that, and you'll hit rock, and then you got to go down below that. In many areas, for example, for the electric power station, which was, oh my God, the whole thing was 1,700 feet long. The power station was 177 feet high. When it was done, it was the largest building in the Midwest, largest building of any kind in the Midwest. And you had to go down 25 feet or so into bedrock below the base of the river in order to get the proper footing for that. So tremendous jobs once you got the water out of the way. You got it emptied and pumped. Then you built another cofferdam and went to another section and on. And, of course, just bringing in the materials was a big operation so that they brought in miles of railroad tracks, and they had their own locomotives moving materials and heavy equipment around the construction site so that a number of the photographs that survive show the construction railroads that were operating there. But a good deal of excavating and, of course, bringing in cement. They use almost 3 million sacks of cement, for example, and over a 500,000 cubic yards of stone, and I don't know how many, roughly the same amount, I think, of cubic yards of sand. So a tremendous amount of materials had to be conveniently brought in and put into place and, of course, made into concrete and allowed to dry and so forth. Yes, he had, recall now that they had something like 25 miles of railroad track in and around the construction site to move all of that heavy stuff, not to mention the timbers, for example, that were brought in also.
It also seemed like, from what I've seen and the pictures and such, it's almost like he built his own little town for the workers doing everything on site. Is it that much? I mean, was it that big of an operation that he kind of had his own little village, I guess you would say?
He did, yes. He built places along the shore where workers could live. And there were a lot of buildings. I don't know the total number of buildings, but a lot of that was created just for this site. And people would come and they'd be amazed at how big the project was. I mean, there's even governors on record coming in from Ohio or from Springfield, Illinois, saying, oh my gosh, I never dreamed it was this big an operation. And so it astounded people, and it was written up in magazines all over the country and in foreign magazines and newspapers and so forth. People were reporting about the building of the Great Dam on the Mississippi River.
That would seem to tie in. I believe, did he hire his own photographer to document the entire process?
Yes, yes, he did. As a matter of fact, he two key people, and I have photographs of both of them in my book. One is G. Walter Blair, who was a odd combination of a physician from Keokuk. Keokuk had a college of physicians and surgeons, incidentally, so they produced a lot of doctors in town. But also he was a journalist, a newspaper man, and very good writer. And he was the head of public relations for it, producing stories that were, of course, not only reprinted in Keokuk newspaper or what have you, but all over the country. And then he hired Herman Anschutz, who was a Keokuk photographer. And altogether, Anschutz took more than 1,500 photographs of the construction project, which, of course, helped me decades later put together the photographic book of the project. So, yes, he did bring those two men in, and they did very, very good work, I think. And I tried to track just how far a lot of their articles and photographs got, and it was really kind of amazing. But he wanted public support for it to be consistent, and it was, after all, a project that had strong government approval, and it was just something, too, that there were a lot of challenges in it, and he just didn't want to fail. He just wanted people to realize how very difficult it was and that he was doing his best and so on. So it really got a lot of public support.
You talked early on about how the idea of what they wanted for Keokuk to grow to be the next St. Louis. When the dam was completed, did they accomplish that? What happened to Keokuk once they got their dam?
No, their dream of becoming a city, of course, was never realized. The town has 12 or 14,000 people today, so it's still small town America. Nice small town, but nevertheless. And so it didn't do that. It didn't boom Keokuk. It didn't do it any harm. It helped it. They put up some buildings. A major hotel, for example, went up, and some other things that were very helpful. And the town was a kind of a tourist stop for quite a while, of people stopping just wanting to see the dam. But it accomplished its major objectives very nicely, but it didn't grow Keokuk into a city like they had hoped. Incidentally, they finished it during 1912 and 1913. Really, the two sides coming from both sides of the river were finally connected in the middle as of late July 1912, and then it took a while, of course, to get the powerhouse into operation, and the current started running through the turbine area later that summer in 1912, and eventually they were successful in sending that current 144 miles all the way down to St. Louis and to some other areas in between. And so it was a very successful operation that slowly sort of was completed. The new lock was put in there because, of course, with a dam, of course, you've got to have a big lock that'll take all sorts of sizes of boats and allow them to go up and down river. The lock itself was 400 feet long, and it was very successful right from the beginning, although it was enlarged, most of half a century later. But the whole project was completed. Actually, they still worked on what they called the dry dock, where they worked on boats for a little while. But the official completion date was May 31, 1913. And then they continued to work on the little dry dock where they repaired boats and stuff. But so basically 1910 to 1913, an amazing project to get it done at all, much less in 3 years of time. But it really ushered in, the important thing was that it ushered in a new era for America's greatest river. It made travel up and down the river just as easy as it is today for both travel and for shipping. And so that had an enormous impact, and the hydroelectric plant was very successful. Union Electric eventually bought the dam and the power plant and the transmission lines in 1925 and took over and ran it for many years. Later on, Ameren UE had it, and it was very, very successful. But no, it didn't make Keokuk, of course, into a city at any time. That didn't work out. But I suspect that the Keokuk folks were not all that unhappy, in any case, by having that great world project done at their doorstep.
Did you follow what Cooper did once he had finished this project? Did you get into that?
I did it one time. I didn't talk about it in Keokuk and the Great Dam, but he continued for a number of years being a world-renowned engineer, and he built a huge dam on a river. The name escapes me after all these years, in Russia, for example, that was absolutely world famous also, and that came probably 10 years after the dam at Keokuk. So he continued in the business for at least another generation.
The city is going to, and Hamilton, Keokuk and Hamilton are going to be celebrating the 100th anniversary of the dam. With your research, with your knowledge, with just your interest, and what would you hope people would think about when they go, they walk through the power plant, they see the dam, they see the festivities surrounding it? What do you hope people think?
Well, actually, that's a good question. On the one hand, it's the amazing size of the project, of course, and its effectiveness. But moreover, it's a look into American history at a certain time period. America, when it said, we are going to control this continent. We are going to make it a place that people can get around in, that we can develop. And here's our key river right down the middle of it. We're going to control that river and everything else. And so it's the mindset, I guess, of the American people 100 years ago when, as I say, we were really at a point of manifest destiny and America can do it and kind of mentality. And that's really what it is an expression of in a lot of ways, as well as, you know, as they look at things. I'm not sure, I don't know exactly what they're going to allow them to see. I know they used to give tours, incidentally, of the powerhouse. You could see the turbines. Then they stopped giving tours after a while because of insurance reasons and so forth. So I don't know what they're going to allow the public to see during this celebration, but just the magnitude of things is going to be a very wonderful experience for the public. And whatever they see, I think it'll be an unforgettable experience for all sorts of people.
Any final thoughts, any little maybe interesting nuggets that I haven't thought to ask about that our listeners would find interesting?
Well, only that I would say this, that small town America had a particular attitude too in the early 20th century, late 19th and early 20th. It was, after all, the period of the rise of cities. By the 1890s, Chicago topped 1 million people, for example, and became the dominant city in the Midwest. And cities were rising everywhere. And small towns, which had their heyday in the 19th century, especially with the coming of the railroad, which allowed those small towns' railroad stops especially to grow. They sort of looked askance at cities as they were rising, and they were kind of envious, jealous of them, really. And they would criticize Chicago at the drop of a hat, or St. Louis or something, because they loved their own smaller town, you know, kind of thing. So it was that kind of rivalry between small town and city America. And this is an interesting story, and one of the reasons that drew me to it, as I mentioned before, because this is the fulfillment, too, of a great dream by a small town that they were eventually got accomplished, as incredible as it was. I mean, it would have been a big project for New York to undertake it, much less for Keokuk, Iowa, to undertake it. But they got the right man, and their own persistence paid off, and they got public officials behind them, governmental leaders, and they did it. So, but it's an expression of the fact that small towns are great, too. Small town people can do great things. Our town is a great town kind of attitude. So it's very much an expression of that. Without Keokuk being right there and being the kind of town that it was, already had a good foothold on the Mississippi River, was already important as a small town, shipping point and so forth. Without that, I don't know when they would have started building dams on the Mississippi River. I really don't. But here's one town that was really ahead of its time in wanting to do that kind of thing. But it was partly as a result of cities rising in other places and not wanting to sort of be left behind, you know, kind of thing.
Well, John, that is exactly what I was looking for. I really wanted your perspective on this. I appreciate you taking the time with me.
My pleasure.